Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with William E. Ellis about his biography of the 20th century journalist and author Irvin S. Cobb, entitled Irvin S. Cobb, The Rise and Fall of an American Humorist. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm a native Kentuckian, lived here most of my life. I did spend half a year in New Zealand on a Fulbright back in 1989, and I got a undergraduate degree at Georgetown College and then a master's degree at Eastern Kentucky University and a PhD at the University of Kentucky. I taught for 4 years in high school, 3 years in a junior college, and 29 years at Eastern Kentucky University. I retired in 1999 and almost immediately had a heart attack and had to have bypass surgery and survived that. And since then, I've been able to do a lot more writing and also play golf and do traveling and enjoy my retirement as much as I can.
It sounds like a very full life.
Well, it's been a nice life. I can't complain about it. I've got a good family and had a lot of support from a lot of different people. I've had some really good mentors in my professional life. And all in all, it's been a good ride.
I was wondering if you could explain to us what it was that led you to Irvin Cobb as a subject.
I'm interested in humor, and I collect humor, and I do some writing. I write for a magazine, Kentucky Monthly Magazine, and occasionally I'll write a humor column of things that I've collected, as well as historical events that may be coming up or something about history. And I've always been interested in humor. So about probably 10 years ago, I started collecting humor and I was working on another project. And Irvin Cobb has been written about. There have been several good books written about Cobb, which didn't stop me from writing another book about Cobb. Not mysterious, but he's an interesting person because of the way he came up in life. And the book is called The Rise and Fall of an American Humorist. Although he came from Kentucky, especially Western Kentucky, which is considered to be the most southern part of Kentucky, some people suggested that I call him a southern humorist. But you can't really call him a southern humorist, although he dealt with a lot of southern themes in his humor, because he went off to New York City and made lots of money, made lots of friends. He was a member of the Algonquin group. He was just part of the New York scene for more than 30 years. So you can't really call him just a southerner. In many ways, he demonstrated what it meant to be a southerner in the early part of the 20th century. And that's for better or worse. Cobb was a racist, which was not unusual for a man of his time and place, and especially where he came from in the most southern part of Kentucky. He came from a background of Confederate veterans, but he was able to transcend that in some ways. In some ways, he never got over it, you might say. but he was a very became a very urbane man, even though he only went to school to the age of 16. But he had an exceptional memory. You might almost call it photographic, and he could recall things from Shakespeare, from other English writers. He had some facility in Latin because one of his father's friends in Paducah taught him Latin. So he was a typical early 20th century, well-educated man, even though he didn't have a great university education. He somewhat flaunted that at times, and that got him into trouble with some of his New York friends because he, in many cases, would just talk too much, and that irritated some of his some of the people that he knew. He was not liked by H.L. Mencken. Mencken didn't think that he really had a great sense of humor or didn't write very well about humor. They never got along very well. And on several occasions and in several of his publications, Mencken specifically criticized Cobb for his style and his writing and his humor. But that was typical of Mencken. He criticized most people. And Mencken is often made out this almost demagogue to a lot of people. Mencken was very arrogant. He was pro-German in both World War I and World War II, as a matter of fact. And he was a racist in his own way. So he's, you know, he's a typical early 20th century person, too, with all of his good things and faults about him. Hmm. So I got interested in Cobb because he is an outstanding writer. He wrote voluminously. He wrote the first time he really got his teeth into a big story was the trial of Henry Thaw in the early 20th century. And that was made famous in a movie that came out, 30, 40, 50 years ago, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing. And Thaw murdered Stanford White, who was the lover, of at least at one time, of the wife of Thaw. And she was a showgirl, and it's a great story of the early 20th century. Cobb wrote in what were called space rates, and the space rate for early 20th century or late 19th, early 20th century newspapermen was to really write as much as you can and write, of course, in an interesting way. Now, this is before radio. It's obviously before television. Movies are really just the flickers in the early part of the 20th century. You don't get talkies until the mid-1920s. So many people, not particularly well-educated people, read a lot. They read newspapers. Newspapers had several editions a day. And Cobb got into the newspaper business because really there was nothing else for him to do in Paducah at the age of 16 or 17. And he found his niche in life. And like most people who are lucky to do that, he was able to capitalize on that and become quite a wealthy man. He was making as much as $10,000 a year by the end of the first decade of the 20th century, which would translate today into hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he was always successful in selling almost anything he wrote. He acted in movies. He did movie scripts. He did plays. He tried his hand at writing a libretto for a musical. And he was very adept at getting into all phases of show business in the early part of the 20th century.
He led this very remarkable life. And in reading your book, one of the things that makes it remarkable is the very humble beginnings from which he came. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us a little bit about his childhood, the Kentucky from which he came, and how it was that he was able to get into journalism.
His family was he makes probably a little more out of it than it is. His family was a middle class family. His father was a Confederate veteran who had lost part of his eyesight during the war and became an alcoholic. And Cobb wrote about that, and I think it hurt him all of his life what had happened to his father. But his grandfather, who was a physician, his mother's father. And other people in Paducah kind of doted on the boy and helped him in his education. And as I said, he didn't have much formal education. At the age of 16, he quit school. And he was soon able to get a job with the Paducah newspaper. And at that time, Paducah was a bustling city. It was southern. It was western. It was on the Ohio River, very close to the Mississippi River. And Cobb, in his life, said that he had a boyhood, much like that of things that were written about by Mark Twain in a much earlier period, of course. And Cobb even wrote a very realistic sort of Tom Sawyer book later in his life. And several critics who read that book, it's called Going on 14, and he wrote other stories in a similar vein, think it's really more realistic than the stories of Mark Twain about Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. So he had this great ability to remember things, to meet people, to be friendly. He was still in his late teens when he covered the story of a Chicago criminal who escaped to Western Kentucky. And he was able to interview this man and send the articles back to the Chicago papers, and made $100 plus expenses, and kind of proved to himself that he could do work like this. He later stayed with the paper in Paducah. He went briefly to Cincinnati and then came back home. He married a young lady from a well-to-do family in Savannah and stayed in one of the Paducah papers for a while. And then she and other people encouraged him eventually to go to New York City. And as Cobb said, the goal of every newspaper man at that time, 1904, was to go to the big city. That's where the action was. That's where the big newspapers were. And there were a lot of famous reporters writing at that time. Some of the most famous people in America were writing for newspapers. And Cobb realized that, and he took a chance. He was about 27, 28 years old when he went to New York. And he mentioned that when he came into New York City, he felt just like the immigrants coming over from Europe on a ship, that it was just an entirely new experience for him.
You make that point in your book that, yeah, one of the things that makes Cobb's rise so remarkable is that it really is this golden age of journalism where you have, as you just mentioned, these really great talents out there writing. This is the heyday of yellow journalism, which was very sensationalistic, but you had people throughout the journalistic profession who were very talented. And Cobb, as you describe, not only very quickly rises to the top in terms of his Western Kentucky community, but he also does so in New York City, which is the largest journalistic market in America at the time.
He did that. It's not as surprising as you might think. There were a lot of people from not only Kentucky, but from other writers from other parts of the United States who went to New York City and made it big. There were also a lot of people that failed, of course, but that was the place to go in the late 19th, early 20th century, if you wanted to make it big. I think Frank Sinatra even sang a song about that at one time. If you can make it big in New York City, or you can make it big anywhere. And this is a time and place where there's a lot of growth. There's a lot of immigration. Factories are booming. It's a period of great wealth, also great poverty. And Cobb was sensitive to all that. He, even though he became middle class, not long after he got to New York City and then eventually started making quite a bit of money, I think he always had a common touch. And he liked to feel like that he wrote for the common people, that he wasn't writing for an intellectual group. And that was the conflict that he had with, I think, with Mencken. And if you read things written by Mencken, a lot of his things are intellectual in a way, but also, I think, kind of put down the middle class and especially put down poor people. The image that you get of Mencken in a movie or like Inherit the Wind is not, I think, what the image of H.L. Mencken actually was. So Cobb was always energetic. His daughter, who wrote a fine biography of her father, And then Cobb also wrote his autobiography toward the end of his life. But his daughter told about how nervous he would be and that he had recurring dreams that at some time in his life he would be unable to keep writing, that he would lose the gift. Cobb's genius, and I think it was genius, is that he could, for at least 30 years, keep not only reinventing himself, but inventing ways of writing about America. He did that in newspaper columns. He would continue a column in newspapers until he went to the Saturday Evening Post, and he would alternate these columns about various people, about how they viewed living in New York City. He didn't have a jaded view of New York City, but had a very realistic view of what life was like in New York City, especially for the wealthy and for the poor and for the middle class. And he could write very well about that because of his powers of observation. Let me read you a little part of my book, if you don't mind.
Oh, please do.
And it's something that a lot of people, I think, overlook. But this story comes from the 1920s. And it's Cobb wrote not only humorous stories, of course, which he's famous for, and he's especially famous for the Judge Priest stories, but he also wrote what he called his grim tales. And these are stories that he, in many ways, took from his from living in Western Kentucky. He wrote one very famous story right at the beginning of his career as a short story writer about a happening on poor people. And he would write about how these people reacted to what was going on in their lives. But this is a story he wrote later on called This Man's World. Two sisters, Annie and Anita, work in a big city department store for considerably less than their male counterparts. Because they were unable to support themselves, they must depend on men. Annie marries a manual laborer who tries to control her every action and instinct. Anita, the younger sister, lives with a well-to-do dandy who does the same. And Cobb says, Annie got herself a husband, Anita got herself a man. Both end up being cast out by these men. Annie is falsely accused of adultery. Anita is thrown out when she develops a goiter. The sisters go back together and attempt to eke out a living, of course, at a lower wage than men. Anita tells her sister, quote, you go straight and I go crooked, and the best either one of us gets of this is the worst of it. Sis, what is the hell wrong with the modern world? Cobb concludes this modern theme by arguing, brute force ruled and man, being physically the stronger, dominated society and women. Well, that's not a funny story. It's a very modern story, and some biographers see this as really a forerunner to what we've been hearing about in the last 30, 40, 50 years about the rights of women, and women should make as much money as men, and more rights and more things should be given to women in the workforce.
Do you think that's an ahistorical reading, or was he very progressive when it came to women's rights for his time?
Say that again.
Is that an ahistorical reading of Cobb, or was he very progressive about women's rights?
He was progressive. Of course, many things to him were comical, and he always had this way of looking at society that I think a lot of people have. That, you know, the world is a funny place, and if you take it as being funny, then you can muddle through life. If you take it too seriously, then life can be a lot harder. That's one of the characteristics of humor, that if you can see the funny side of life and the humorous side of life, it makes it a lot easier. And that was what Cobb considered to be his objective in life, to point these things out to people and to show them how life could be a lot easier than they thought. He also, of course, at the same time, he's got this hard edge to him. He had something of the small town boy who goes to the big city, and his daughter in particular thought that on a lot of occasions he was quite prickly about his life. She talked about how he would be unkind to people at times. He had three major operations, or three major health problems, as well as eventually becoming too fat. He ate too much. Coming from a family, especially a father who was an alcoholic, he did drink. He wrote a lot about liquor. He was opposed to prohibition right from the beginning of the idea of prohibition. He was elated when prohibition ended. He wrote about the bourbon industry in Kentucky. And some people have asked me, they've said, do you think he drank too much? I don't think he did. I think he realized the problem that his father had. I think he enjoyed good bourbon. But I think at the same time he was he realized that it could ruin his life just as it had ruined his father's life. He portrayed himself as the happy fat man. And that's what you see in his books. He always made fun of himself in that way. Now, is that because he really felt that way, or is that a self-defense mechanism? I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't say that. But he was, as far as mental health is concerned, I think mentally healthy most of his life, until maybe the last two or three years of his life. And we can talk about that in a little bit later. But he wrote these grim tales, and he wrote stories that people like to read about. Some people have compared him with, in some of his grim tales, with Edgar Allan Poe, because they've got kind of an eerie side to them. But one critic says that Cobb's stories are always very realistic, and the stories of Edgar Allan Poe are many times just otherworldly and nothing based in reality.
It's fascinating to consider just how prolific he was, because you think about the life of a reporter and how so many reporters of that day were just focusing upon the reporting. But as you've already explained, he also wrote these short stories longer works. What was his work schedule like? How was he able to produce this gigantic corpus of writing?
He worked, somebody asked me one time about his nightlife. One person even asked about, did he play around with women, and did he do this, and did he drink a lot? And I think for the most part, Cobb was pretty straight about everything. He got to bed early, especially when he moved to the suburbs. He did on two occasions, and actually longer on other occasions, moved outside of New York City, and then he would have to commute into New York City. And then commute back home at night, which took some time. But he worked on schedule, and he would write not only a lot of different things. He might work on a story for a newspaper, on a short story, and on several short stories at one time, and keep these separate from each other. He had voluminous notes, and I've seen some of these in some of the collections that I've been to. He did a lot of revision. And of course, as everyone knows, if you write for a newspaper or a magazine or newspaper, whatever it happens to be, the editors are going to do some revision. And I don't think the editors of most of his editors ever had to do much revision, because he revised things several times from what I've seen of manuscripts. He would send manuscripts in the different collections that I've seen to different people. And they would be substantially the same story that's going to be published, but there'd be a little bit of a difference. And he would cut out something, he would add something. So he was constantly revising. Once he became wealthy enough, once he had enough money, he hired a secretary. And she did a lot of his typing and his revisions. And, of course, if you write for a major magazine, as the Saturday Evening Post was in the early part of the 20th century, they had, you know, all the secretarial help you could desire. He turned out some years in the Saturday Evening Post and later in other magazines a story or an article about every other week. And that it took a lot of time. It took a lot of effort. He stewed over it. He worried over it. His daughter recalled that he always wore a vest, as men did at that time, and he would twiddle with the buttons on his vest until he pulled those off, and then he would set those down on a table. And then when she was a young girl, it was her job to sew those buttons back on his vest again. So he was a warrior, and he did have this recurring nightmare that, you know, he might lose it someday. And eventually he did lose it. He did lose his ability to create things, which we can come to later or whenever you want to.
We can come to it in a little bit. I actually want to get to his reporting of the First World War, because you do spend considerable space in your book talking about that. And it's something that is very interesting, because you both highlight this very important period in the world, of course, but also the ways in which he confronted this major event and the ways in which he wrote about it.
World War One, even reading 100 years later about the beginning or the course of the war, the end of the war, it's like all wars. It's one that should never have been fought for many reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all the major crowns of Europe were related to each other. Why should they get involved in a war like this? And it all had to do with trade and with colonies and with industrialization, with militarization, the building of big navies. And eventually there was no international means to stop this. Cobb was already writing for the Saturday Evening Post and was on vacation, and he got a letter from Lorimer, who was the editor of the Post, that his ship left in something like 4 or 5 days, and he was sent a pack that even included a revolver and gold sovereigns. Cobb said that he went to Europe jingling like a milk wagon, all these points. and he and 3 or 4 other men got to the continent. They went to the Belgian border. They floundered around. They finally were actually captured by German soldiers. It's a wonder they hadn't been killed. He did say, and the men with him said, that they did not see German atrocities. And to his dying day, people argued that he did see atrocities. But he did what he did see were... or what he said he saw were Belgian civilians who were either spying on the Germans or actually shooting at them, and that they were summarily tried by German authorities and executed. When he got back home, people questioned him about this, and he said the war itself is an atrocity. It's not just the individual things that you see. But he was very good at describing what war looked like. He described the sights and the sounds and even the smell of war. He, on one occasion, was taken by some German officers to a fort in Belgium, Fort Lincoln, L-I-N-C-I-N, I think. I've forgotten how it's spelled. L-O-N-C-I-N. And they were riding around on horseback and then on automobiles around this tremendous fort that the Belgian army had built. And it had been... bombarded by heavy artillery by the Germans, and then there was an internal explosion. And Cobb said that they got to one side, and then they suddenly smelled this horrible odor of decaying flesh. And I've forgotten his exact words, but he said something to the effect that once you get that odor in your system, you never forget it. And he never forgot it. So he wrote about war in a very realistic way. He told the Germans when they released him and the others that he was going to go back to the United States. They went to England. He had an interview with Lord Kitchener, which Lord Kitchener denied having. And Cobb wrote about that. He covered not only stories for the Post, but also for newspapers. And turned out one of the best books, I think, ever about the realities of what war is like, right at the beginning of World War One, before the United States became involved. And then was given a great feast in New York City. He was honored by everyone in New York City. And then shortly thereafter had the first of three what were called gastric attacks, bleeding of the intestines, which could have killed him, but it didn't. And he survived that and ended up eventually even making jokes about it. He made jokes about being in Germany. The first part of his original book, he was very serious about everything. But 10 years later, he sort of joked about the experiences of riding a German train troop train back into Germany. And he and his companions were very hungry, and he reached out the window and grabbed a sausage because they were so hungry, just to have something to eat. He could have that side to him, but there was always this very serious side to Irvin Cobb. And I'm not a psychiatrist, and I don't try to be that in any way, but there was always something of the, I think, the small town boy who felt that he always had to prove something in the big city. And of course, that's true. If you don't, it will you could be destroyed in some way. And he would write people. One of his friends in Kentucky in the 1920s said he wanted to come to New York City and start a career. And Cobb said, don't do it. Just stay where you are and do what you do. And you'll be a lot happier, because it took me so long to get started in New York City and to be a success. And most people don't find that kind of success.
It's a success that, as you by 1917, 1918, as you describe, he's not just a writer, he's a celebrity.
Oh, quite. And as I say, this big dinner that was given for him in New York City, everyone in New York City came there to this great dinner. And it was well organized, and the band played My Old Kentucky Home and all that kind of thing. He was I'm not going to say nonplussed by all of this. I think he enjoyed being a celebrity. And one time he was asked by a magazine, what do you think about being a celebrity? And he said, it's wonderful to be a celebrity, but you have to keep proving yourself over and over again. And once you lost that, then it's quite damaging to your self-respect. And that's what eventually happened to Cobb in his later years, when things changed. Not only his career changed, but entertainment changed, humor changed. One thing that I think changed Cobb is that in more and more ways he became more of a comedian than a humorist. While he was writing, for the most part, he was a humorist. And he could. He often said that when you're a humorist, you have to keep doing something new all the time and writing something new. If you're a comedian, especially on the stage, and he wrote sketches for some comedians. He said, if you're a comedian, all you have to do is just keep doing the same thing night after night after night, because a different crowd comes into the theater and they laugh and everybody thinks you're original. When you're not original, you're just doing the same thing over and over again for a different audience. But if you're a writer, those people will keep a record of what you write, and they'll call you to task if you do the same thing over and over again.
It was the range of activities that you describe in your book in the 1920s and 1930s that just was really interesting, because in my mind, I was making that comparison to Mark Twain in the sense that Cobb was a humorist and he was a writer and he produced books and this range of material. But in the 1920s, with the advent of modern technology, radio, and then movies, he branches out and he becomes in a modern parlance, he expands his profile. He becomes a figure on the screen. You describe his friendship with Will Rogers and how he and Will Rogers are performing on movies, and it's just such a very interesting development for someone who had started out just as a journalist and a humorist.
Yeah, well, it's an example of the evolution of entertainment. Entertainment changes with first of all the flickers, the silent movies, and he appeared in a silent movie or two. And then you have, eventually you're going to have the talkies in the mid-20s, and then you're going to have radio in the early 1920s. And Cobb, for many reasons, was always looking for a way to make a little bit of money, a little bit more money. And for many years, he made an awful lot of money. He spent a lot of money on homes. On two occasions, he built homes outside of New York City, which were quite expensive. His last home that he purchased in California, in Santa Monica, had originally been the home of Greta Garbo, and before that, another silent movie star. I looked that up on the internet not too long ago, and it's right now it's valued at something over $10 million. It overlooks a golf course. It has, I don't know how many rooms and bathrooms and swimming pool. I don't know what that house cost in about 1935, but it would have been a lot of money. So he spent a lot of money and had to keep writing and had to keep producing and had to keep making a lot of money in order to keep his lifestyle. That takes a lot of out of a person. If he could have been this a writer who there's one I've used as an example in here, George Ade, A-D-E, was a writer who lived in Indiana, who wrote for Chicago papers and magazines. He made a lot of money. He remained a bachelor, I think, and eventually gave a lot of money to Indiana University. The football stadium is called Ross Ade Stadium. But he stayed in one place. He stayed in Indiana. He didn't rumble about like Cobb did. He didn't try to do more than what he really was adept at doing. And what Ade did was just write about Indiana, Midwestern people. And Cobb did more than that and had more friends and had more opportunities and got into, as you say, into radio and movies. He even, in the early days of television, when television was just being invented, he said that, you know, this is going to be one of the greatest things in the history of the world. And, of course, it has become one of the greatest things in the history of the world, as well as the other media that have developed since then. But he was always looking for the next chance, the next opportunity. And that came from his ability to see what was going on in the world. It also came because he always thought he had to do something a little bit better all the time.
And yet, as you've already inferred, there is a decline in his output and in his ability near the end of his life. What did he just exhaust himself? Did he spread himself a little too thin? What exactly happened to him?
Several things. He did, for example, he did become older. He did have more and more health problems. His last two or three years of life were very miserable. He died in 1944. He became more and more conservative politically as life went on. He felt that in some ways life had passed him by and that he was no longer appreciated as much as he once had been. His saving grace for a while was when he was asked to come to Hollywood. That was 1934, I think. And he's already, you know, becoming an older man. He's going to die 10 years later. He's becoming an old man. He's his style of humor is becoming a little bit outdated. This is the mid-1930s. I might also say that you know, everything's changing in the 1930s because of the Great Depression. And people who were once heroes are no longer heroes. One of the things that really hurt him more than anything was he eventually lost a newspaper column. That went through several stages, and Cobb, several days a week, not always 5 days a week, would write, you know, just humorous stories. And it was a moneymaker. When he lost that, he lost a pretty good chunk of his income. But in 1934, he was asked to come to Hollywood by Hal Roach to make a series of comedies, short subject comedies, much like the Laurel and Hardy comedies and Our Gang and things like that, which were very popular. And Cobb was not a success. as an actor. And if you see some of the pictures of him in makeup and dressed comically, he doesn't look like he's really enjoying it. But he did that because it was a way of making money. His daughter said that he really always had wanted to act and to be an actor, and he now had his opportunity. Well, that series failed. But in the meantime, Will Rogers, John Ford, kind of took him under their wing, and he became an advisor for the Judge Priest movie. The Judge Priest movie made by Will Rogers in, I guess it was 1934, was based on Cobb's stories, but not written by Cobb. And it's a syrupy Southern story. It's got all the stock characters, including Stephen Fetchett, who played the black man in it. It's got a Southern belle. It's got the old Confederate ideas behind it. And it was a very popular movie. And, of course, anything that Will Rogers made was popular. Rogers was, I think I say in the book, and I know this sounds kind of harsh, but it's always a good thing to die at the right time. And Will Rogers died in a plane crash in Alaska right after Steamboat Round the Bend had been made, in which Cobb had played a role. And he was such a popular American. Democrats and Republicans loved him, and he's famous for that saying that he was a member of, what was it, the most disorganized political party. I'm a Democrat.
I'm a member of no organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Everybody just loved him, and he was a lovable character. But few people realized that during the height of the Depression, when most, you know, a lot of people were in breadlines, he made $120,000 for a movie plus a big percentage of the receipts, gross receipts. So he was the common man, but not a poor man. And he portrayed himself, as somebody that could just identify with anybody, and he could. And he and Cobb became friends, and Cobb became kind of a semi-advisor on some of the movies that were made about the South. And Cobb loved life in Hollywood. The problem was he was becoming older, and his health was declining. And in the meantime, he decided to try to cash in on it. He was in two or three movies after Steamboat Round the Bend. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it's a you know, kind of hilarious mid-1930s Will Rogers movie. And it's one that you know, most people could watch if you can put up with the racism in it. And Cobb played a minor role, but he's not, obviously not an actor, and he could not pull off anything like what Will Rogers could do. John Ford made a lot of movies and a lot of great movies. Will Rogers is kind of the second or third in line of the heroes that he put in movies. The first was Harry Carey, and then Will Rogers, and then of course one of the later heroes he uses all the time is my mind's left me for a minute.
John Wayne.
John Wayne. Yeah, I forgot about John. Yeah, John Wayne. And if you read recently about John Wayne, writers say that he was entirely a creation of John Ford, and that John Ford quite often made fun of him. Can you imagine somebody making fun of John Wayne, the great hero of all these movies? But he did. So Cobb didn't quite fit into what was happening in Hollywood. In the late 30s, movies become more serious because of what's going on in the world. You know, the rise of Japan, Nazism, Italy, Mussolini. The world's getting to be more and more dangerous place. There's a little bit of improvement in the American economy. But certainly not, you know, great prosperity. Cobb got to be more and more conservative as time went on, and especially developed an enmity toward President Roosevelt, especially toward Eleanor Roosevelt. And he became an enemy, really, of Senator Alvin Barkley, who was from Kentucky and who for a short time had been in Paducah at the same time that Cobb had been in Paducah. So it's, you know, he's a man with a lot of pride, and he should have a lot of pride because of the accomplishments he made. But hubris outdoes us all eventually, and it certainly did in, I think, the character and the great things that Cobb did. So that's why I call it the rise and fall. He was, he rose as high as anybody can, and he fell. Not maybe as far as everybody could, but his last years, he was in bad health. In Hollywood, his wife came there. His daughter, who went through eventually three marriages, brought her children out to Hollywood, out to Santa Monica, to this beautiful home, and they had to kind of scrimp and save. They didn't give parties like they did when they first got there. She told the hilarious story about her father. He had terrible teeth. Eventually had to have his teeth pulled and had dentures. And they went to a movie one night, and he took his dentures out because they were uncomfortable and put them in, thought he had put them in his pocket. And she said when they got home, they found out that she could tell by looking at his mouth that he didn't have his dentures. And she reminded him, and the next day, somebody at the theater found his dentures, but he was not a very cheerful person in his last years. Hmm. And of course, as you know, with my bad back, I'm standing up giving this interview right now, so I can testify to being not in the best of health at the age of 78.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before you go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I still write articles for the magazine, Kentucky Monthly. I try to do something new and fresh every month. I keep 2 or 3 months ahead right now. And these are only 900, 1,500 words. But that takes more work than you might think because I like to make them factual and not controversial, but at least interesting to people. Right now, I'm working on Floyd Collins, who was a caver who was trapped in a cave in Kentucky in 1925. And it was absolutely one of the first big news stories comparable to Lindbergh's flight, which is, of course, in 1927. A man trapped in a cave for several days. He eventually dies in the cave, and he is used by the press. He's used by people. He was a very common man in a very terrible situation.
Wasn't that the inspiration for Ace in the Hole?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Yeah, which is in another part of the country, but you know, it's a story of an average person in a terrible situation, and how they either get out of that situation or they don't get out of that situation. In this case, he didn't make it. And then later in life, his body is put on display, and it's all part of terrible publicity stunts by a lot of different people. So I'm working on humor, which I'm still very interested in, and different types of humor. And I may do some writing about humor, but as I've told people, at the age of 78, I could not do a book like Irvin Cobb again, because it took so much time. I had to travel to libraries, which I love to do, but to go to Houston and get driven out of town by a torrential rainfall, which we did, and then went to University of Texas, Austin, 2 or 3 times to look at papers and to go to other libraries. Takes a lot of time and effort. And I don't really have the energy to do that anymore. It took, I didn't read every word that Irvin Cobb wrote, but I read a lot of it. And a lot of his things are repetitious. And some of the stories are derivative, but I still tried to read as much of it as I could. And as I've told somebody not long ago, I said, I have not written the last book on Irvin Cobb. There are going to be more people, I hope, will write about Irvin Cobb and see him in a different way. But the way I saw him was, you know, that he was a great man who rose to great fame and fortune, and then began to falter and fall and did not live a happy life. He died miserably. He had several ailments, including diabetes, retention of water, which had to be taken off, and couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, and you know, missed the old lifestyle of being with people, and that's pretty hard to give up in your even in later life.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us about Irvin Cobb and his life. I hope you have a wonderful day.
All right, glad to do it. Thank you.